From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. And with just 3 days to go until the first presidential debate, both candidates are off the campaign trail today. But we're here with our weekly political roundtable.
Here and Now!
2016!
And joining us today, Greg Moore, former editor of the Denver Post and Hearst Professor of Journalism at the University of Colorado. He's in Denver. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Maria Elena Salinas is a news anchor at Univision. She's in Miami. Hi, Maria Elena. Welcome back.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, and we're going to get to the debate in a minute. But first, both candidates reacting this week to the police killings of black men in Tulsa and Charlotte. Let's listen here to Hillary Clinton.
We are safer when communities respect the police and police respect communities.
And then here's Donald Trump on Fox News.
I would do stop and frisk. I think you have to. We did it in New York. It worked incredibly well. And you have to be proactive.
Now, Greg, stop and frisk was ruled unconstitutional in New York. Trump says he was just talking about wanting it in Chicago. But how do you hear all of this as it fits into the presidential race?
Well, what I hear Trump saying is law and order at any cost. And I'm not sure that he was even aware that a federal judge had ruled stop and frisk to be unconstitutional. But there's a lack of sensitivity there on his part when he mentions those kinds of tactics that have been used generally to profile and oppress inner city populations, particularly black and Latino. I will say this about Trump. He did surprise me in talking about the case in Tulsa, where he said, you know, in a sympathetic kind of way that, you know, this seemed unjustified, that he didn't know what was going through the police officer's mind. And as we all know, she was charged with manslaughter yesterday. So, you know, he has the capacity to be sensitive, but it just doesn't always come through.
Maria Elena, what do you think about that? I mean, who is the focus on police-related killings? Who's the focus helping, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump?
I think for now, Hillary Clinton, because she has been pretty consistent with her opinions. And now it seems like Donald Trump is trying to have it both ways, not only promoting stop and frisk, but he's also promoted racial profiling in the past. And recently, although he was referring to the bombings in New York and to people that might look Arab or might look suspicious, I think that it applies to just about everyone who usually gets stopped, who usually gets racially profiled, which includes African Americans, Latinos, and Muslims. So with the comment that Greg just mentioned right now, it seems like he is trying to have it both ways, because up to now, he has consistently been on the side of the police and consistently criticized African Americans for having so much violence in their community. And I know that what he's trying to do is get the African American vote, but it doesn't seem like he's helping himself, especially with the comment that he made the other day talking about African American communities being in the worst shape they've ever been, ever, 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 ever.
Well, and we also heard political analysts say that what he's actually doing there is not even going after the African American vote, but trying to get white suburban voters to be more comfortable with him by saying some of these things, this outreach, as he's calling it, to the African American community. But there've also been a number of comments that have raised eyebrows this week about African Americans from the Trump campaign. And a Trump County chair in Ohio had to resign over comments that she made this week. Here's what Kathy Miller told the Guardian newspaper.
I don't think there was any racism until Obama got elected. That we never had problems like this. You know, I'm in the real estate industry. There's none. Now, you know, with the people with the guns and shooting up neighborhoods and not being responsible citizens, that's a big change. And I think that's the philosophy that Obama has perpetuated on America.
Now, Greg, again, she resigned after making those comments. But what are your thoughts on that? And do you think that view is widespread among people who are supporting Donald Trump?
No, I actually don't. I don't think that would be widespread. I do think it reflects a level of unsophistication and ignorance on the part of the candidate and some of the people around him. And I really wish that Trump would invest some time to actually go to some of these communities and talk to some of the people who live there. But besides, you know, all this focus on violence in inner city communities, which, by the way, are not all African-American, white people live there, too. I would really like to see Lester Holt step up during the debates and ask these candidates about what their urban policy is. I mean, mm-hmm. we have not heard urban policy discussed on a national level in a couple of decades. And I think it's time to get past platitudes and mantras and really get down to some specifics. And I think the debate on Monday, if we can get to that topic and talk about broader issues, will be great for the candidates and also great for journalism.
Well, Maria Elena, chime in here. I mean, what do you make of the idea of asking about urban issues more directly during the debate? And what other things would you like the candidates to be questioned on?
Well, we're hoping that it will be. The topics are America's direction, achieving prosperity, and securing America.
The most broad topics of all time.
Yeah, but it could fall in there. It could fall in there depending on how Lester Holt manages this. You know, it's a very tough position for any moderator right now, and I'm sure that Lester Holt is going to be under this pressure and preparing. I just saw him during the Emmy Awards this week, and he was making a joke as presenting, taking a paper out of his pocket and saying, "Oh, these are my questions. Anybody want to see them?" So, you know, the moderator does get to pick the topics and does get to pick the questions. I'm sure he's gotten some help from his team over at NBC, but hopefully the topic will come up. For sure, the immigration topic will come up, but I'm sure because it's a part of what's in the headlines, and in any debate, I think you need to discuss whatever is in the headlines at the moment. I'm sure that this topic will come up.
Who do you think has the edge, Greg, going into the debate?
I think Hillary has the edge only because she has more experience in one-on-one high-stakes debates. But, you know, Trump is going to be Trump, I think, and whatever he does is not likely to change what his supporters feel about him. But for Hillary, I think there's some perils there. I think she needs to make sure she, in the words of Obama, comes off likable enough that, you know, she doesn't seem authoritative and lecturing. And it's going to be a delicate balance for her because she's well-versed in policy. And, you know, if Donald Trump just demonstrates the least amount of grasp of or trying to grasp the issues, I think that he's going to earn a second look from independents. So, but I think Hillary has the edge at the moment.
Well, you know, if I can weigh in on that, because I think that I think one of the advantages that Trump has is that the expectations are so low. People are expecting him to be the same Donald Trump that was debating his opponents during the primaries. And if he comes off that same way during a general election, it might not help him so much. So I think that he just needs to be half decent in order to win because the expectations are so low for him. But, you know, Greg, you say Trump will be Trump, but we don't know which Trump is going to show up. Is it going to be the Trump that we have? Yeah. Is it going to be the Trump that we've seen with the teleprompter? He's not going to be able to have a teleprompter during the debate, during this debate. Or is it going to be the one that is used to attacking and demeaning his opponent?
The Trump that we saw during many of the primary debates, right? So speaking of Hillary Clinton, because Greg, you're talking about her before. You know, in weeks past, we had talked about Donald Trump's outreach to African American voters, and Hillary Clinton has been trying to energize millennial voters to support her. And she went on the mock interview show Between Two Ferns with comedian Zach Galifianakis.
I'd love to meet the person who makes your pantsuits.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because for Halloween, I wanted to go as a librarian from outer space.
I think that would be a good look on you.
I might be too old, but I didn't exactly laugh. But Greg, what do you make of this, of Hillary reaching out to younger voters?
You know, I think she's going to have to be more substantive than that. You know, it's funny. It shows that, you know, she can laugh at herself and that kind of thing. But I think there's some fundamental issues that aren't being addressed by either of the candidates. But when it comes to millennials, they want to hear about, you know, how they can get rid of some of this debt, how they can begin to accumulate some wealth, how they can afford to save money and buy a home and make
sure
they can get a job.
Also, climate change, I've heard, is something the millennials would like to hear.
Climate change, the environment. They want to hear about the issues. And that's why I think these debates are so important. Is that if Hillary wants to connect with millennials and people of color, she really, really needs to not rely on sort of past relationships and past history, but actually get out there and talk about the issues that will excite the electorate and turn them out.
Maria Elena, just a few seconds left here, but I just want to ask you about your colleague Enrique Acevedo, who's been on the show before, who got into the news this week because he found a portrait of Donald Trump.
Exactly. He took the time to walk over in the to the Doral Hotel here, very close to Univision, and he found that famous or infamous $10,000 portrait of Donald Trump. That, by the way, was paid by the foundation's money. In 2014,
right.
You know, but it seems like it was interesting and it was a fun fact and it was nice to find it. I don't know how much that is going to have an impact on the voters, though,
yeah.
Because as we know, Donald Trump can say and do anything can they can dig up any dirt on him from the past, and people who support him will continue to support him no matter what happens.
That's,
so I don't know that it's going to have that much of an impact, but, you know, more proof. Now we know where it is.
Maria Elena Salinas and Greg Moore, thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
It's a
pleasure. Good to be with you.
Can great architecture heal? That's the bold question that a tireless Alabama civil rights activist and a Massachusetts designer seek to answer next year when they plan to open the nation's first memorial to the victims of lynching. Between 1877 and 1950, more than 4,000 African Americans were lynched, murdered in some 800 counties across the American South. Unlike in Rwanda or South Africa or Germany, there is no memorial yet in this country that confronts the legacy of these acts of violence. But next year, the Equal Justice Initiative plans to open a national memorial to the victims of lynching in Montgomery, Alabama. Brian Stevenson is the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, and he described to CBS why he thinks this memorial is so important.
The smog created by that history of racial inequality continues to compromise our health. And there's no place in this country where you can go and have an honest experience with the history of
lynching. And why? Do you think it's because it's too painful?
I think it's because we have created a narrative of denial. We think if we own up to our mistakes, something bad is going to happen to us. We're going to get punished. And I'm not doing these projects because I want to punish America. I want us to be liberated from the chains that this history has created.
It's an ambitious goal. And how do you do it? How do you design a modern physical space that liberates from the chains of history? Is that even possible?
Well, memorial design is a challenging and controversial thing these days. And many scholars talk about the best way to think about memorialization. Is it a static or is it a dynamic thing? Is it temporary? Is it something very permanent?
Michael Murphy created a space that is all those things. Murphy is executive director of Mass Design Group, the Boston-based architectural firm that designed the National Lynching Memorial. And he described that design in a TED Talk earlier this year.
The memorial will take us on a journey through a classical, almost familiar building type, like the Parthenon. But as we enter, the ground drops below us, and our perception shifts, where we realize that these columns evoke the lynchings which happened in the public square. And as we continue, we begin to understand the vast number of those who have yet to be put to rest, and their names will be engraved on the markers that hang above us. And just outside will be a field of identical columns, but these are temporary columns waiting in purgatory to be placed in the very counties of where these lynchings occurred. Over the next few years, this site will bear witness as each of these markers is claimed and visibly placed in those counties. Our nation will begin to heal from over a century of silence.
This is what makes Michael Murphy's work so interesting. He believes that great architecture has the power to heal both individuals and entire nations. And in fact, his firm has created an entire philosophy of design around that notion and has deployed it around the world. That's where we focused our conversation when I spoke with Murphy a little earlier.
Right there on the Mass Design website, there's this very bold statement that architecture is never neutral. It either heals or hurts. Now, for the places that are deliberately designed to promote some kind of national or even individual healing, I get that. But Are you saying that all other architecture, most other architecture, damages us in some way?
It's a provocative statement, but I do fully believe it, that architecture is not simply an object. It's not simply a sculpture that we use or inhabit. It shapes our daily lives. We live in buildings 90% of our lives, and it shapes our behavior. We really learned this, especially working in places like Rwanda or Haiti with amazing doctors. And the design of medical facilities is a particularly acute example of where spaces shape behavior. They shape health outcomes. If you look at prisons, there are many, many examples of where the space itself is causing people to suffer. And here are very, very direct examples of where architecture can be violent and injurious and hurt people. So we must ask, how can it be beneficial? How can it foster healing? How can it be proactive? And think about positive behavioral change. Mm. This is a provocative idea in that, you know, some want to believe that architecture is just a luxury, that those who can afford it use it and benefit from it. But if we do see our built world as a place that is shaping our everyday lives in major and micro ways, then we are introducing architecture more as a behavioral science and as well as an art form, something that we can work together with to improve our lives on a daily basis and also calculate and measure how it is doing so.
Yeah, you know, I think I have been in spaces beforehand where I have felt uplifted by the design of the space. There's something about it that definitely, you know, sort of moves you. But you're also talking about like literal healing in a certain sense. I mean, some of the work that you were talking about in Rwanda that you've done with the hospitals did exactly that. Could you give us just an example or two of some design elements that you put in your work in Africa that promotes healing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see this notion of healing in different scales. I mean, there's definitely the healing of the body, how one uses a space and how it can affect your physical health. In Rwanda, we were encountered hospitals where the designs of patient rooms had not been thought about. The designs of hallways and waiting areas had not really been thought about. And in a particular hospital that Dr. Farmer introduced me to in South Africa, patients walked into a hallway where other patients were sitting with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis and airborne disease. And those same patients coughed on each other and cultivated this disease in that space, and many of them were immunosuppressed. And then they left the hospital with an extremely drug-resistant strand of TB. Simple designs for infection control were not thought about, and people died because of it. This is a crisis, right? This is where it's not only space, but it is certainly an element of the total package of what's causing this disease to be incubated and transferred and then to actually kill people. The director of the hospital said people died because this space was not designed correctly. Mm. And so you have examples of that there, and we want to ask, well, what are the examples we can design that would not only resist those potential disease transfers, but help to foster healthy living?
Describe to us what you can about the design of the lynching memorial that you hope would invoke that healing.
That really informed the design of the memorial. We thought not about just having a statue or a place to visit that would stay the same, but one that would change over time. And that very DNA of having markers that could be removed from the site and placed in other counties throughout the country where these killings occurred allowed us to create a memorial that was active, one that would engage the communities where these atrocities had occurred, would bring people together like a barn raising or like an active participatory process to really build this movement of truth and reconciliation that we seek.
Well, you know, you've taken this idea of architecture as a potential healing force and turned it into almost an entire philosophy, right, of the built world. In your TED Talk, you presented it as the low-fab philosophy, hiring locally, sourcing materials regionally, training artisans and laborers when you can. And then I was very intrigued by the fourth part, which was investing in the dignity of the community that the building is intended to serve. So thinking about the lynching memorial in Montgomery, How is that, the fourth part there, going to be manifest? Because, you know, this is a memorial that isn't without its own controversies in the very city where it's going to be raised.
Just having those set of questions at the outset forced us to think about the process of building differently. And one thing that came about in our conversations as our organizations designed this together was the thought about collecting soil of these places where people were killed and bringing that soil back in individual jars and showcasing that soil as a remnant of the unmarked places in our country which tell a deeper story that we often don't know. Brian and his team now have been going on a series of soil collection efforts and bringing community members and leaders and descendants together to bring this soil into these jars and bring it back to their headquarters. And it's an amazingly moving and powerful initiative and very much came out of these conversations about what more could we do, how many hands could we have to make this memorial, how many people could we bring together to build this and change this narrative collectively.
Well, we've just got a couple seconds here left to go, but I am curious. I mean, for a major national monument that addresses, you know, a historical trauma in American life, I can see how the healing philosophy of architecture applies, but can we apply what you've been talking about today to architecture on a smaller scale, on the quotidian scale that most of us encounter?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, architecture is not just the creation of huge heroic buildings. It's the everyday decisions which construct our lives. It's the simple decisions from where you source a material to who builds that building to how that building functions to where we walk in our city streets to the equity of our neighborhoods. These are decisions that are must be designed. And if we ask the harder questions about what else could we do, we could be making more informed and positive decisions about our built space instead of just letting the private sector build it all.
Well, Michael Murphy is founder and executive director of the Boston-based Mass Design Group. He's the architect of the Equal Justice Initiative's Memorial for the Victims of Lynching that will open next year in Montgomery, Alabama. Michael Murphy, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Immigrants and the impact they have on jobs in the United States have been major topics in this election season. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump obviously have very different views on the matter. But a new study has tried to find where the truth lies. And business journalist Ali Velshi joins us now from New York with a glimpse into that study. Hi there, Ali.
Hey, Magna.
So this is from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. What did it find about immigration and its impact on jobs?
And these are three different academies that got together to do this study. It looks at economics and demographic trends over the last 20 years, and it finds very little evidence that immigrants take native-born workers' jobs or lower their wages. High-skilled immigrants, like those in technology and sciences, actually have a positive impact on both college-educated and non-college-educated native-born Americans because they spur innovation, which then creates jobs.
Mm. So overall, they're saying that the net impact is negligible, if not at all.
Yeah, and now it spreads it out. It breaks it down and says that in certain areas there is impact and certain impact is negative, but net-net, immigrants' contributions to the labor force makes them integral to the economic growth in America because they do bring new ideas and they add to a labor force that would otherwise be shrinking. And this is important for America and for Europe. They have shrinking populations, if not for immigration.
Okay. Well, Ali, but let's take a quick look, if we can, at those areas that the report says do feel an impact. I mean, what are the particular sectors or certain wages? What are we talking about?
The first generation of immigrants usually costs the government more than that immigrant contributes in taxes, mainly because of the cost of educating children. And those costs fall on state and local governments, not the federal government. First generation immigrants are also on average less educated and earn less, so they pay less in taxes. Now that, Magna, has been changing over the last 20 years. Increasingly, we're getting more educated first generation, but the total cost for first-generation immigrants is about $57 billion. Obviously, as you get to second-generation born of people who moved here, things start to look a lot more better economically.
Well, given that, Ali, I mean, how does this report either play into, verify or not verify what both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have been saying?
What this talks about is the type of immigrant that you're getting into the country. Donald Trump has largely focused on those who are economically in the worst position, generally people coming from Central America through Mexico into the United States, and they're working for the lowest wages. Now, this does say that even those immigrants help the system, but fundamentally, you've got to look at immigration holistically. You've got to say that there are some very poor people coming in to do the lowest wage jobs in the country. We're also depending on immigrants for some of the highest skilled jobs in the country, particularly in engineering, computer sciences, and coding. So all it means is you've really got to take a 50,000-foot view. Donald Trump tends to be taking a bit of a 5,000-foot view on immigration, and the 5,000 feet tends to be right over the Mexican border.
Does the study then have any policy suggestions for whomever might be the next president?
Well, it doesn't make them directly, but there's really thinking amongst people who study this that the government should do more like what Canada or the United Kingdom does and sort of try and determine a policy that encourages a good balance. In other words, you're getting highly skilled immigrants, particularly those who are coming here on visas to get an education, then don't get a visa to stay here, so they take their American education and go back somewhere else. That does encourage finding a balance between those types of immigrants and the immigrants coming over the border. We seem to need both, but we do have to have some policy areas around it.
Well, that's business journalist Ali Velshi. Ali, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Magda.
And you probably haven't heard much about this next story on NPR this week, although you've most likely heard it somewhere. Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are getting divorced. The superstar celebrities have been married for just 2 years, though they've been together for more than a decade and have 6 kids. The specifics of their situation aside, divorce is something that half of Americans who get married have or will experience. And joining us to talk about that is Susan Brown, who's a professor of sociology at Bowling Green State University and co-director of the National Center for Family and Marriage Research. Susan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And we often hear that statistic that 50% of marriages end in divorce. How accurate is that?
I think that that statistic remains pretty accurate, but one thing is that it obscures important variation in divorce by age. So we're seeing two different patterns for younger and older people these days in terms of divorce. For younger people, their risk of divorce has actually dropped over the past 20 years, whereas for older adults, we've seen a doubling of the divorce rate, and we call this the gray divorce revolution.
And how do you explain that?
Well, there are a number of different factors that have led to the rise in gray divorce. Certainly one of them is that many of the people who are experiencing divorce in their 50s and 60s are the baby boomers who experienced the first divorce revolution back in the 1970s and the early 1980s. And many of them went on to form remarriages. And we know that remarriages are more likely to end in divorce than first marriages are. Another factor is that older women and younger women these days are more likely to be working, and so they have the financial independence to call it quits if they're not happy with their relationship anymore. So I wouldn't say that older adults who are married these days are any less happy than their preceding generations were, but rather women in particular have the financial security and autonomy to seek a divorce if they're dissatisfied.
I also wonder if younger people are getting married at a later age and therefore maybe they don't get into something that they decide later that they don't want to be in anymore.
That's correct. We're seeing that marriage today is a lot more selective than it was in the past. So as fewer people are marrying, it is increasingly those who are the most advantaged in terms of education, financial security, wealth, who are choosing to tie the knot. And that helps in terms of marital stability. Those couples are less likely to get divorced, but that's in part because they were already in a very strong position before they even got married. That was a prerequisite for marriage today that wasn't there 20 years ago.
And how do income and education fit into the divorce rate?
Well, people who have higher levels of education or have more financial resources tend to be less likely to get divorced. And economic instability is very destabilizing for relationships. I don't think that's too surprising. What's interesting, though, is particularly for young people, the bar to getting married is so high that many can never surmount it. So those who are in more precarious financial situations may want to get married, but they don't feel like they can really afford to. And so what we're seeing is that it's those who are the most advantaged in the first place who are tying the knot as young adults.
Well, when we look at the reasons in some research from the Journal of Family Issues, we see infidelity tops the list for a reason people get divorced. Incompatible is number two. Drinking or drug abuse, grew apart, personality problems. And then way down the list, you've got financial problems, physical and mental illness, interference from family. That's in there just about 2.5%. But lots of reasons people get divorced.
That's right. Yes.
Given that divorce is so common in this country, why do you think, and I'm saying this as a child of divorced parents, why do you think that when people go through it, they're just there's no sort of guidebook of how to get through that moment, whether you're one of the kids, whether you're one of the parents? It's just something that a lot of people don't talk about until it's happening.
Well, I think it goes to that notion of how what a stressful life event it is and that nobody can be adequately prepared for it. I mean, we're definitely the marrying kind in the United States. We're eternal optimists. Nearly everybody wants to get married. The vast majority of people do marry, and most people who get divorced go back and try again with a remarriage. So we definitely have a strong affinity towards marriage and are hoping that we're not going to be in that one in two statistic of marriages ending in divorce. But then when it happens, that's a very different reality, and understanding how to adjust and navigate to that can be a real challenge for people.
And as someone who studies this, do you have any advice for anyone if there's somebody listening who's about to go through a divorce?
Well, that's a tough question. As a sociologist, I don't have much expertise in marital and family therapy. I mean, I would suggest to people, I guess, simply that it is stressful. And so seeking help is something that people should consider if they feel like they need it, because it could be very difficult to navigate it by oneself. And social support, whether it's from friends, family, or professional help, could be vital to their adjustment.
That's Susan Brown, who is a professor of sociology at Bowling Green State University and is the co-director of the National Center for Family and Marriage Research. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today's young couples may be less likely to get divorced. They're also less likely to be able to buy their own home, perhaps because they're saddled with student debt. Ben Marcus from Here and Now contributor Colorado Public Radio reports from Denver.
Kate Nestorwitz was a teenager when she decided to get her master's degree at a private school to be a family therapist. What she failed to consider was how that decision would affect her life some 13 years later.
I just tried to get pre-approved for a mortgage and did not, because I was 1% off for the debt-to-income ratio because of my student loans. That was heartbreaking.
Together, Nestorwitz and her partner graduated with more than $100,000 in student debt. They pay it down by about $2,000 a month.
And so if you rack that up over time, that's certainly a down payment on a house. I find the most disturbing part to be when I do my taxes and see the interest that gets paid every year. Last year, I paid $6,000 in interest.
So Nestorwitz says she's cobbled together three jobs to earn extra income. And she's leaving her nonprofit family therapy job for private practice, hoping to eventually earn even more. The dilemma for young professionals like Nestorwitz is the longer they spend paying down their student debt, the more they fall behind. Lawrence Yoon is the chief economist for the National Association of Realtors.
As the home values rise much faster than income, they feel frustrated. They feel like they are being left behind. And furthermore, even as they are renting, the rents are rising, so they feel squeezed on all fronts.
Nationally, home prices are up nearly 30% in the last 5 years. Rents are up 20%. But in fast-growing cities like Denver, rents and home prices have both risen by about 50% in the last 5 years. Yoon says combine that with record student debt levels, and it's not surprising that the home ownership rate among young people is at historic lows.
Fewer people are participating, and this is one of the contributors of wealth inequality that is developing in the country.
Because home ownership is a key wealth-generating investment for the average American family. But not everyone sees such a bleak housing market. Charles Roberts is a longtime real estate agent in Denver who runs Your Castle Real Estate.
So it's never a perfect world, and there are always winners and losers and victims. And right now, you're identifying certainly one of them. But I think overall, I prefer the world we have today to the one 7 or 8 years ago where every other person was losing their home, it seemed like.
In other words, it's tough that young people can't qualify for home loans, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. 7 or 8 years ago, people saddled with debt or low incomes were getting mortgages they shouldn't have, touching off a crisis that brought the global economy to its knees. Robert says people like Kate Nestorwitz are doing the right thing, continuing to pay down their debt and pursuing higher paying work.
The good news is that we expect a lot more of these young people to be able to buy in the future as they get better jobs and can put more money in their pocket.
Still, Nestorwitz, who just turned 30, isn't keen on waiting. She's even delaying having kids with her partner because of a lack of housing security and because of her debt.
With so much instability and so much following you, it's like a dark cloud over your head. Never goes away.
She's only lived in Colorado for a couple of years, and like some young families in the Denver metro area, the allure of cheaper places to live becomes even more enticing.
You know, we have a bunch of friends that live in like Iowa or these middle states where I would not want to land. I don't want to leave this area, but yeah, it feels like you need to be upper middle class to live here.
And anxiously watching prices continue to rise unabated makes Kate Nestorwitz feel nervous, a little bit like she can't afford to live in Colorado anymore. For Here and Now, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
Fall officially started this week, which means a brand new slate of TV shows, including the show Pitch on Fox. In that show, Kylie Bunbury plays Ginny Baker, who becomes the first woman ever to play Major League Baseball. Here she is talking to her dad and then a teammate.
A girl will never be able to throw hard enough to compete with boys. Not as they start growing. It's biology and we can't change that. That's why we need a secret weapon.
What is it?
It's called a screwball.
Enjoy your moment in the sun, because there's 29 pro teams as we speak figuring out that little trick pitch of yours. And when they do, I'll get my job back and you'll become the answer to a trivia question.
Okay.
Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
And let's talk about this show, Pitch. What do you think makes it work right now?
TV shows work best when they're about something that's a little bit ahead of where we are now. So there's been a lot of talk in sports. You know, what sport will be the first sport that is all male that will welcome female competitors on a professional level? And so it feels like something that could be happening right now, but it's a little ahead of where the sport actually is.
Well, another show premiered this week with huge ratings. This Is Us, and I've already heard somebody talking about how great this is. It drew 10 million viewers for its premiere on the first episode. Here's a clip with Gerald McRaney playing a delivery doctor talking with a young man who just lost one of his triplets during labor.
I like to think that maybe one day you'll be an old man like me, talking a younger man's ear off, explaining to him how you took the sourest lemon that life has to offer and turned it into something resembling lemonade. If you can do that, then you will still be taking three babies home from this hospital. Maybe not the way you planned.
Eric, tell us about this one.
So this is a show. It's very interesting. It's a drama. Of course, it involves families. It centers on four people who are the same age, who have the same birthday, and who are linked in a way that I won't explain because that's a huge spoiler, even though the pilot episode, which reveals that twist, has already aired. We meet these triplets, the two that survive when they're adults. So it goes back and forth in time, the story does, and it's very well done. It's complex. My only question is, where do you go from the pilot where the twist sort of resets the board in a way and reveals connections between these characters that you couldn't have imagined when you started the story?
Hmm. Well, we've been talking so far about network TV shows, good old-fashioned network TV shows. Right now I want to talk about another show that is returning in its third season on Amazon. This is the show Transparent. And here's a clip from the trailer with Jeffrey Tambor playing Maura Pfefferman as she blows out the candles at a birthday party with her family.
What'd you wish?
Well, one of the things I wished for is that you don't call me Mappa anymore.
Why?
I thought you liked Mappa. How about you guys can start calling me Mom?
You want them to call you Mom?
I would love that.
Eric, what do you expect for the third season? Because the first and second were really great.
Right. Well, Transparent, the spine of Transparent is always the transition of its lead character, Maura Pfefferman, transitioning from male to female. And so we see that transition deepen as Maura considers gender reassignment surgery, The thing that's always been difficult for me with Transparent is that all the characters are incredibly self-centered.
Yes.
And so that speech that you heard, for example, Maura had not told her ex-wife, who is the woman who gets called mom by all these characters, that she wanted that, and had not told her girlfriend, who's played by Angelica Houston, that she was considering gender reassignment surgery, which is a pretty major thing that you would discuss with someone that you have a romantic relationship with. And these characters are all doing that. You know, of course, Maura's children are all struggling with different issues in different ways, but they're doing it in such a self-centered way that sometimes it's hard to connect with the characters. But some of the major criticisms of the show, the self-centeredness of all the characters, the lack of racial diversity in the cast, those problems still remain and have not been dealt with that much in this third season.
Okay, what are we missing, Eric, that we should be talking about, shows to watch this fall and shows to avoid?
Well, there's an interesting show on HBO called High Maintenance. You know, we've got a little bulge of shows that deal with pot and deal with weed. And so this show is about all the different people who are connected to this unnamed pot dealer. I think he's called The Guy on the show. It's very good. It's really interesting. It's an under-the-radar kind of show. Also, I would say stay away from this show called The Great Outdoors. Joel McHale plays this outdoors writer who's celebrated, and he is forced by his company to work in the office. And he works with all these millennials, and he's in his 40s, and these crazy millennials, they're so, you know, they expect to get a trophy for everything. It's every stereotype about millennials sort of shoehorned into a show. And it's such a ham-fisted and sort of inelegant way of exploring those ideas that I really have come to hate this show. So,
well, not mincing any words right there.
One to see, one to avoid.
Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, thank you so much, as always.
Always a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.